function. Justice for the human family, we demand it. Justice, truth, freedom, equality's a must. Us, decolonization of the planet, so bust this.
Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, or CRISJ. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. I'm Elvia Ramirez, a professor of ethnic studies at Sac State, and I'm here with Maricela Martinez-Cola. Today we'll be talking about Dr. Martinez-Cola's book, The Bricks Before Brown, The Chinese American, Native American, and Mexican American Struggle for Educational Equality. The book was published in 2022 by the University of Georgia Press. Okay, so let's get started. Maricela, can you please introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being able to speak about my book and the cases that I got a chance to learn so much about. But yes, my name is Maricela Martinez-Cola. I am an assistant professor at Morehouse College, assistant professor of sociology at Morehouse College. That's a historically Black college for people who identify as men. That's in Atlanta, Georgia.
All right. And can you tell us a bit about your personal or your familial background?
So I was born and raised in Battle Creek, Michigan. So I tell people that I am a Michicana from Michigan. My mother is from Reynosa, Mexico, and my father's from Donna, Texas. And I joke around that they either really like cereal or they threw a dart because they ended up in Battle Creek, where my sisters and I were all born and raised. So that's my familial background.
And can you tell us a bit about your educational background? For example, where did you receive your PhD? Where do you teach now? And what do you teach? What classes do you teach?
I'm the first in my family to go to college. I always make sure to make that a point, to anytime I get a chance to speak to students or, audiences like yours, just to be able to let them know that I think being a first gen scholar, is very meaningful to me. And it's an identity I'm very proud of. I went to the University of Michigan for my undergrad, and I majored in psychology and African-American African studies. Then I did what every good first gen student is supposed to do. You either go to medical school, law school, engineering, or business, right? So I stink at math and science. So that knocked three out right away. But I could, quote unquote, argue well. So law school seemed the right fit for me at the time. So I went on to law school at Loyola University Chicago School of Law and earned my JD there. And while I loved the study of law, I hated the practice of it. Absolutely hated it. So I only worked in it for a year. And then I turned to student affairs, and I was director of multicultural affairs at a variety of institutions around the country, including George Washington University, University of Georgia, Agnes Scott College. And I was in there for about 10 years. Then I had my son. And when my son started going back to school, I looked at him and said, "Mama's going back to school," because I knew that I wanted to join the academic side of the house, but I knew I could only do it if I had a PhD, because my law degree didn't count as a terminal degree to become a professor. So when he started pre-K, I started to go back to school for my PhD, where I earned it in sociology at Emory University. That's a college in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where I earned my PhD. I worked at my first job out of grad school was at Utah State University. And I was there for my first 3 years as a professor. I ended up going to Morehouse College, where I actually did, when I was in grad school, I did a dissertation completion fellowship there. So I did a fellowship for a year, and I absolutely fell in love with Morehouse, like completely and utterly fell in love with Morehouse and thought, I have to get back here. And so I jokingly told Utah State, "I'm very loyal. You have me, I'm here, unless Morehouse calls." And so I made that joke, and at year three, I told them, I said, "Guess what?" And, I said, "Morehouse called." And they just knew that there was no way they could keep me there, because I needed to get back to Morehouse. And so then I came back to Morehouse College, love it there. And I've just put up my my materials for tenure. So I'll find out officially May 17th how that goes. So the kind of classes I teach there at Morehouse, I teach, of course, intro to sociology. I teach criminology. And I teach, there's this class that I created called Social Inequality with Nina Simone, where we take songs that Nina Simone sings and we study the inequality that she sings about in those. And it's really fun because the final project for that class is a curated playlist. I got that idea from a friend of mine, for that assignment, and the students love it. And I teach race and ethnic relations occasionally and contemporary social theory.
Wow. That's exciting. All right. Okay, so let's go straight to the book. Can you tell us about your book, The Bricks Before Brown? What is the main message you're trying to convey in this book, and why is this message important?
So The Bricks Before Brown is actually my dissertation. I think a lot of times there's a hope that, your dissertation can become a book. And when I first started in grad school, that was my hope from the very beginning, is that I wanted it to become a book. And I wanted it to become a book because I believe the stories that these three cases tell, or that really all the cases tell combined, tell a lot about, the struggle for educational equality in the U.S., and a lot of times when you think about school desegregation or school segregation, a lot of people think that it's often, limited to the South, like that it's centered in the South, right? That it's usually happened in the 1950s, and that it occurred between a black-white binary of race. And so I wanted to be able to contribute to the knowledge that's out there about school, segregated schooling, school desegregation, by adding to the narrative the stories of indigenous, Chinese American, and Mexican American plaintiffs, and to tell a fuller, richer story, to share a fuller, richer story about school desegregation in the United States. And so that was really my hope, was to be able to do that. I often share with students that this was a project that developed when I was actually in student affairs, because there was an event that my students went to. It was a Black History Month event, and it was about Brown versus Board of Education. And I had a Latino student and an Asian American student come into my office afterwards, and they said, "Maricela, did we do anything?" And, meaning, did Latinos and Asian Americans do anything? They said, "Did we do anything, or did we just sit on the sidelines and basically let, Black folks do everything, And I said, "No, of course you did something. You absolutely had to have done something, because I know how the law works, right? The law works. It says yes for this population, and then the other populations come forward and say it applies to us too." And so that's actually what started me down my research road, was looking for those other cases for those students. And so that's how I ended up doing that. So this was also, in addition to just it's more than an intellectual exercise for me. It was a gift that I wanted to give to those students who ask, "What did we do?"
It's powerful knowing that students had a very direct role in your production of this research and scholarship.
Yeah,
all absolutely. Right. Yeah. So, and can you tell us a bit about the legal cases then that preceded Brown versus Board of Education?
So a lot of people don't realize that the struggle for, equality in education began 100 years before, over 100 years before Brown versus Board happened. In fact, the first case happened in 1849 in Boston, Massachusetts, with Roberts v. Boston. And that was a case that was started by a young girl, and her father was an abolitionist. And so they, struggled to fight that. Now, she didn't win the case, at the time. And so it really started this whole, you see this trend then from there moving throughout all the states, and this struggle, coursed its way all around the country, all the way to California and Iowa and Ohio. So it wasn't just in the South, and in fact, 10 cases. So I identified at the time of my publishing my book, 105 cases that had been filed into the appellate court system and had an actual opinion on record, right? And so there was 100, over 100 cases were filed over 100 years time period. So this battle was a long time coming. It didn't just suddenly appear in the 1950s. There was, plaintiffs, 90% of the plaintiffs were Black. Then the next group, there were five cases involving Native American plaintiffs, four cases involving Chinese American plaintiffs. And then at the time that I did the research, two cases, but there's more than that involving Mexican American plaintiffs. So it's a very long, storied tale to tell.
All right. And in your book, you describe in depth three separate legal cases, including Tate versus Hurley, Piper versus Big Pine, and also Mendes versus Westminster. Can you tell us about each of these three cases and why are they important?
So when I first started doing my my research, I expected to find the cases around the 1950s, you know, and so that's when I thought that most of the cases would be centered. And then, of course, the first case I found, which did sort of fit that, was 1947, Mendes v. Westminster. But then when I kept looking, it started, the Chinese American case, the very first Chinese American case happened in 1885 out of San Francisco, California. And that involved a Chinese American family, the Tate family. It was Joe and Mary Tate had three children, and their eldest daughter, Mamie Tate, was rejected from the school closest to their home. It's almost the same narrative with each one. The school closest to their home, they get rejected. And the father ended up suing the school. And so what they did is that they won the case, actually. So it should have been a victory, right? Well, the reason why they won it is because the way that the law was written at the time, the law said that all children have the right to go to school. But the judge in the opinion sort of says, wink, wink. Right now it says that, but if you get the law changed, then you can do whatever you want. So they delayed her entrance into the school, you know, several times over until they were able to legislate the lobby the legislature to get it so that, you know, school districts can decide, you know, how they're going to who will be allowed in the schools. So they built an entirely separate Chinese school for five children, and two of them were the Tate children. And so they did all that just to keep Chinese kids out of white schools. And so that was really, you know, sort of a remarkable find then. And there's so much more to the story there. The mother, wrote this scathing letter to the newspaper editor that she addressed to the school board, that was just absolutely brilliant. I mean, I'm mad as hell, mama bear, you know, kind of letter that I just absolutely loved. And it gave me goosebumps when I first found it, you know. So then I looked, and in 1924, the centennial is coming up, was the Piper v. Big Pine case. And that was in Big Pine, California. These are all California cases, by the way, which is really interesting because there's a lot of people in California that have never heard of these cases. Alice Piper, what happened there was a new school that was being built, and the white people in the community promised to let Native American children go to the school, to the Paiute children that were there, go to the school. But they went back on their promise and said, no, you can't, and tried to come up with this idea that you had to live within 3 miles and, you know, sort of all these extra extraneous rules that were really meant to keep, you know, Indigenous children out of the school. And so Alice Piper sued, they sued the school, but they sued it under something called the Dawes Act. And under the Dawes Act, it says that if you adopt civilized habits, quote unquote, adopt civilized habits, then you can get citizenship. Yes, you can become citizens of the very country that you've occupied forever, right? So then if you become a citizen, then you would get the rights to be able to go to white schools. So when you read the opinion, it sounds like the family, the Piper family, were kind of selling out. You know, they're like, yes, you know, they adopted civilized habits, you know, which meant a number of things. It was such an, you know, obscure sort of reference. And so in this particular case, it meant that they weren't living on the reservation, that they owned land outside of it, you know, things like that. And so they won the case, right? But one of the wonderful things I did when I was doing the research, you know, is that when you tell you, that's what the papers tell you, right? So the papers tell you that, but the people tell you a totally different story. And so when you interview the people, You come to find out that Alice Piper did not leave her community. In fact, she retired on the reservation. Her parents are buried in the tribal cemetery. And then I was able to confirm through their Bureau of Indian Affairs records that they still kept their names, their native names, in the record and things like that. So I really love that case because it really kind of shows a very subversive way that they got around segregated schooling there. And then, of course, the very next case that happened was 1947 Mendez v. Westminster, which involved Mexican-American children. And this was a really huge effort. In this particular case, an aunt took Sylvia and her brothers to the school, along with her cousins. Now, the cousin's last name was Vidaduri, so it was a very sort of European-sounding last name, and their cousins were much more light-skinned than the Mendez children were. The Mendez children were fairly darker skinned, right? And so the administrator said, we'll take these students, but not those. You know, so they pointed to the light color, you know, to the cousins and said, we'll take them, but we won't take them, meaning the darker skinned Mendez children. And of course the tia, you know, did the right thing that a tia is supposed to do. And she was like, forget y'all. And she ended up taking the kids back to the school and told Gonzalo Mendez, the father, what had happened. And then he ended up suing the school district and recruited 5,000 families to join from five different school districts around that area to join the lawsuit. And so much happened again with that. Now, one of the remarkable things about Mendez is there's so many beautiful connections to Brown. The first being that the NAACP met with the attorneys from the Mendez case because a lot of times Brown is credited with being the first case to use social science, but it was actually Mendez. Mendez used an anthropologist and an education specialist to be able to talk about the effects of segregation on the children. And so the NAACP met and said, we want to use that skeleton. We want to use your skeleton for our cases, and ended up, you know, using that. And so that was a really beautiful connection, sort of a Black-Brown connection that I love to always, you know, point out when it comes to those two cases. And Mendez was a very multicultural case as well, because you had the Japanese American Citizen League, you had the NAACP file, what they call an amicus brief, you know, in the case. But the really, really cool connection was, so what happened was it got appealed all the way. They won the case and the school kept appealing it all the way to the Ninth Circuit. And they won it at the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit is just below the Supreme Court. So had the school appealed one more time, Mendez would have been the Supreme Court case on school desegregation. However, what happened is the governor of California at the time ended up integrating all the schools, the public schools in California. So it made it kind of a moot point, right? Excuse me. What's the point of, of continuing this if you know, the schools are already integrated anyway? Now, the governor of California at the time, his name was Earl Warren. And Earl Warren went on to become Chief Justice Earl Warren of the Supreme Court. And his first case was Brown versus Board of Education.
Unbelievable. Amazing, powerful story. Wow. Yeah. Which is why everyone out there, you need to read this book. Copy. So what legal and or political strategies did the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in these school desegregation cases use to help their case?
You know, one of the things that a thing that you need a lot when you're filing a lawsuit or when you're in a criminal case, any kind of case, you need a sympathetic plaintiff, right? You need a client that's going to be sympathetic. And I believe that these attorneys specifically, you know, at least put forth these sort of, middle class representations of Americana. To be able to sort of have people relate to, connect with in some way, shape, and form to their clients. You know, one of the things, for example, that is pretty interesting was when you look at a picture of Sylvia Mendez, a very famous photograph, she's photographed in front of a piano. And so then when I was doing my research, turned out Mamie Tape, the Chinese American plaintiff, she played piano. And a reporter said she plays it as well as any American girl, you know, is the phrase that he used to describe her piano playing. And then when you look at Linda Brown, when you look at the newspaper accounts of when they ask her, what is she going to do when she graduates school? She said she's going to teach piano. And so of the four girls, three of them played piano, you know, and I think that that is so telling, you know, and on who the sort of this, they needed to kind of have this middle class, middling position, you know, they were too young to be criminalized or sexualized, according to all the images that existed at their time, but they were also too middle class to be pitied, you know, necessarily. So I really feel like, you know, attorneys, when they're trying to find sort of the right client, you know, or the right lead plaintiff, you know, whether or not they explicitly say it, right, they're looking for the right person to be able to lead the case. And in this particular case, I think they found three plaintiffs. You know, one of the things about the tapes is they were very wealthy. So they were able to sustain a lawsuit, you know, as long as they were able to. Within the Piper case, Alice Piper was significantly lighter skinned, you know, than there were five children actually in that, and there were four boys and her. And the young boys were much darker skinned than she was. But I believe she had to be the lead plaintiff because boys may have made it more problematic, you know. And in all these cases, younger boys were available to be the lead plaintiff. So if you were going for sympathy, you'd think age would be it, right? But that wasn't the case. I think that, you know, the fear of interracial mixing was so strong, you know, that it's better to have young girls. That's why I call them in my book, I call them my pretty little plaintiffs, you know, because they're, you know, much more sympathetic. Whereas young boys grow up to be men, and you don't want these young boys sitting next to these white girls, you know, in these classrooms, you know. And so that's one of the things that I think the strategies that the attorneys were using, what I believe were the strategies they used to find the right plaintiffs.
And also in the last chapter of your book, you share with readers about your experiences being challenged when trying to construct a more inclusive narrative of school desegregation. Can you tell us about these experiences? Like, why do you think there is some tension with this type of work?
There were sort of two kind of things that happened, you know, to me. The first was when I was first proposing the research, you know, many people said, you know, you can just do a case study on just the Mexican-American case, and that'll be enough to get you through your dissertation, you know. And I remember saying, no, absolutely not. I have to tell their stories. I don't tell their stories. I share their stories. You know, I have to share their stories side by side. It's the only way it made sense to me, because I thought it told a richer, more valuable story to be able to see how all of the groups contributed to this narrative around segregated schooling or educational inequality. And the other thing that happened is I was sharing my research with a white colleague, and she said, see, Black people are not the only ones that suffered. You know, they had other people had problems too. And oh my goodness, that was like the last thing I wanted anybody to take away from my research, you know, was, you know, this sort of oppression Olympics, you know, sort of mentality to come out of it. Because what I wanted it to see was, what I wanted the research to do was to just tell a more compelling story, you know, and to tell that it's not a linear story. It's not a straight, you know, Black and white, South, non-South, you know, 50s, not 50s. It's, you know, it's not a linear story. It's actually a story that takes lots of curves and twists and shapes. And you need to be able to sit in the complexity. Race is complex, right? Race and racism is complex. And I wasn't, and I made it very clear that I was not trying to put an equal sign between the experiences of Chinese Americans, Native Americans, Mexican Americans, and African Americans. You cannot do that. However, white supremacy is so efficient in what it does that it shows up in very similar ways. You know, so you can put sort of the mathematical simile sign, you know, in between the cases to be able to sort of look at what it is that they had. What are some of the critical connections that they had, as well as the meaningful differences. And I don't think we do that enough. I think that we fight so hard for connections that we don't recognize that there are some really important differences that we need to be able to discuss, you know. So one of the things I try to tackle in my book is this, you know, notion of anti-Blackness that exists in, you know, in Latine, Asian American, and Native American communities that we don't talk about enough, you know, that I think can really encumber racial solidarity in a big way if you don't recognize, you know, the challenges that come along with it as well. So yeah, that's a long answer to your question, but yeah.
That's powerful. And I think that comparative aspect of your work really just makes it stand out because mm-hmm. again, there is quite a bit of research that focuses specifically on just one community, one minority community, but yours again is very inclusive, very comparative, and also very intersectional. You know, mm-hmm. you've highlighted the role of race and gender, class, age, all these vectors of inequity, right, that shape the experiences of the plaintiffs with these legal cases. And I had another question. What does school segregation look like today? I mean, I've been reading newspaper articles. A lot of articles are coming out about school segregation. What does the research tell us?
The research is really quite depressing, you know, to be honest. You know, right now, apparently, you know, according to, you know, a report from the Education Department, 3 in 5 Black and Latino students and 2 in 5 Indigenous students attend schools where at least 75% of the population are students of color. Even as a side note, so a school was named after Felicitas and Gonzalo Mendez, the parents, Sylvia Mendez's parents, was named after them. And, you know, that's a really beautiful honor to have. But what's really sad about it is it's a predominantly Latino school. So, you know, it is a school that is essentially segregated, named after people who were fighting that kind of segregation, you know. So to give kind of a story along with the statistics, you know, that's really what's out there right now. And, you know, many scholars say that we're more segregated now than we were in the 1950s, you know, and the challenge was at least back in the 1950s, when you had segregation, many of the children, the Black children, were in schools with Black teachers, right, and Black administrators. And while they did not have the funding that they needed, you know, to really be able to compete necessarily, right, they still had teachers that loved them and cared for them, you know. And then when you, what happened when, you know, one of the unintended consequences of school desegregation is that all of a sudden you have all these Black teachers and administrators who now don't have a job. You know, because these white schools are not going to hire them, right? And so you've got these highly segregated schools today where a majority of the teachers are white teachers, right? And so you end up still getting that really challenging sort of dynamic racial, unspoken oftentimes racial dynamic where it's not just enough that you love to teach and that you love the children. You really need to be culturally competent. And so you unfortunately have a lot of teachers that are just not. You know, and so back in the 1950s, you ripped many of these Black children away from teachers that love them and placed them in a classroom with teachers that would hate them, you know, and unfortunately, that's the case sometimes still today where you have students, you know, Black and brown students are disciplined at much higher rates than their white counterparts. You have, you know, graduation rates that show and graduation and I don't call them dropout rates. I call them push out rates. You know what I mean? Because these children are pushed out of school. You know, they don't drop out. They're pushed out, you know, and those numbers, those numbers are just as depressing. And I wish I had a happier sort of, you know, answer to that question, but it is really quite depressing. And believe it or not, one of the biggest offenders is New York City. New York City has the most segregated school system in the country, you know, and New York is supposed to be sort of this, you know, this area, this liberal bastion, right, of where there's supposed to be sort of a lot of, you know, all these different worlds all in one place, which is true, but they still segregate.
So this shows that clearly that despite, you know, the end of de jure segregation, that de facto segregation is alive and well. And maybe this speaks to some of the limits I suppose, of legal strategies for ending school desegregation. Again, those are important, but I think the struggle definitely continues and must be waged, I think, maybe through the courts and in other ways as well.
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the best ways I've ever heard it described is, I think we focus so much in, and while I do use the word educational equality in my book, what people are fighting for now, what advocates are fighting for now, is school quality. They're, the quality of the education, and they're fighting for equity. And the best way I've ever heard it explained to anybody is that equality means everybody gets shoes. Everyone gets shoes, right? But equity is everybody gets shoes that fit. And that's the biggest difference, is being able to give schools what they need to be most successful and to recruit more and more Black and Brown, Indigenous and Asian American teachers to come into these classrooms, to be able to help students see themselves in their books, see themselves in their teachers.
Representation matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And do you have any concluding comments or thoughts about this conversation, your book, that you'd like to share with all of us?
Sure. I had hoped, when I wrote the book, I didn't write it with just an academic audience in mind. I wrote a book that I was hoping I could read to my mom and she would understand. My mother has a second grade education, but she's one of the smartest women I've ever met. And I didn't want my book to just go on a bookshelf and collect dust. I wanted that this could be more meaningful than that. And so I'm hoping that it reaches a much broader audience than just, sort of people that are stuck in their ivory towers, and wanting to sort of earn a new wrinkle in their brain or what have you. And I also made this book, you mentioned it before, I made it, I wanted it to be inclusive. I wanted it to be intersectional, and I wanted it to be interdisciplinary. Now, the challenge that you have with that is that, it's hard to make any one audience happy, right? The legal scholars are going to say there's not enough law, and the sociologists are going to say there's not enough sociology, and the historians are going to say there's not enough history, but I hope that I was able to bring the stories together enough, brought my love of law, history, and sociology together in a way that, shares the beautiful stories of these families. I fell in love with these families as I was researching them. And there's a part of me that hopes that, that I've answered the question to those students that asked me a long time ago, did we do anything? And this is my answer. Yes. Yes, of course you did.
All right. So to the audience, again, the book is titled The Bricks Before Brown, The Chinese American, Native American, and Mexican-American Struggle for Educational Equality. Again, our author is Maricela Martinez Cola. Get your copy today. Everyone, thank you for listening. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all. You just listened to the Building Justice podcast. The information contained in this podcast, including its title and description, represent the views and opinions of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Sacramento State, Chris J., and/or the Building Justice Podcast Committee.